Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower here until 5 a.m. The opening bell will kick off at 5, and then Steve Cochran, the great Steve Cochran, at 6 a.m. on this Thursday morning. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Anytime you want to get a hold of us, 312-981-7200. Check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show, and on Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, my guest coming up here is Dan Feinberg. Dan is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, has been a part of my show for a few years now, and is always a great guest, knows so much about TV. We love talking TV with Dan Feinberg, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, and that's F-I-E-N, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print, and we're going to talk TV with Dan Feinberg, and we welcome Dan back. How you doing, Dan?
I'm doing well. How about you, Nick?
Not bad. Welcome back to the show.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, great. Lots of stuff to talk about. I would first like to talk about you tweeted a little bit about the American Masters episode that aired this past week about Mike Nichols that was put together and directed by Elaine May, and you were disappointed by it.
I was. It was weirdly short. With these American Masters episodes, sometimes they can be 2 hours, they can be 4 hours if it's Walt Disney. This one was 53 minutes.
Yeah.
It was basically one interview that Elaine May didn't do, and then some very, very basic clips, a couple okay talking heads, but really I expect more depth and more interest from American Masters, and honestly, I expect more personal insight from Elaine May, given the life that those two people had together and the career that they had together.
Yeah, I must say, I mean, I watched it because, you know, it's Mike Nichols and Elaine May directed it. So, of course, I'm going to watch it. And it was enjoyable. Now, where did that interview come from? I kept thinking to myself, God, when did this interview happen? Because I knew Elaine May didn't conduct the interview. But what era are we talking about there? Do you know?
I think it's fairly recent. The credit at the end of the documentary was that all of the interviews were done by one guy who was not Elaine May, and so I don't know if she came on late to assemble it afterwards. Julian Schlossberg did the interviews, and I don't know if after he passed, they passed the material along to Elaine May and said, here, we think you're the person to do something with it.
Right.
I don't know the exact provenance of it, but whatever it was, it didn't come together for me as anything enlightening. But HBO has their own Mike Nichols documentary that's premiering in a couple weeks. Apparently it's 73 minutes,
oh.
So getting a little bit more and maybe it'll be closer to what we were looking for.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I mean, I still enjoyed watching it simply because it's, you know, one of my favorite people ever, you know, directed by one of my favorite people ever. So, but I was disappointed that there wasn't more, and they skipped it. I mean, they really, obviously at 53 minutes, they skipped so much. And, you know, barely mentioned certain things. Like, one of my favorite collaborations between the two of them was Primary Colors, and that didn't even get mentioned.
There's sort of this narrative that was in this particular film, that they had this career together, but then that they never worked together again. You know, sort of that was the time they worked together. Then he went on and did theater. Then he went on and did movies.
Right.
Then he stopped doing movies for 10 years. You know, everything was very, very easily quantifiable, and I don't think his career was that easily quantifiable.
Yeah.
And they put him into a really small box, I thought, and I think Mike Nichols is a man who deserved the bigger box.
I agree. Well, hopefully 20 more minutes will do that. Who knows? All right, well, let's get into it's something entirely different. And I just yesterday morning watched The People versus O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story. And I know that you've seen it and you've reviewed it. I purposely did not read your review because I wanted to hear what you thought of it while you and I spoke. And I got to tell you, I was, I don't know how I feel about it, but I was extraordinarily entertained while I was watching it. I have to say that. I don't know if I've actually come to terms with, exactly how I felt about it, but I know I had a great time watching it. And I think we can discuss it. So, but where do you stand on it?
Well, first of all, I've seen 6 episodes.
Oh, okay.
Of 10, so
okay.
That's where I'm working from on this. So
okay.
I can tell you a few things that I enjoyed more as we went along.
Okay.
Because the first episode is good, and it gets us to a certain place. But for me, the miniseries really kicks in when Courtney B. Vance shows up as Johnny Cochran. That's the point at which it becomes something that is at times often really excellent. I thought the premiere was very good. I think it tells the story in an interesting and compelling way, and most of the actors are very good, John Travolta's eyebrows aside.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, it's so funny that you mentioned that, like, as the show goes along, you know, the introduction of Johnny Cochran is when it really kicks off. Because in the pilot episode, or the premiere episode, he is so great in it. Like right out of the gate. The first scene where he's inside his walk-in closet, you know, trying to get ready for the day and trying to pick out the colors of what suit he's going to wear. From that first introduction of his character, I'm like, whoa, okay. Courtney B. Vance is going to be the man. You know what I mean?
Totally.
And like, he leaps out onto the... I mean, I thought all the performances were fun to watch, but he leaps out, and I particularly thought Cuba Gooding Jr. Was really great. But it's so funny that you mentioned Courtney B. Vance, because right out of the gate, I thought he nailed it.
Oh, no, he's fantastic. And, of course, as everyone who knows the story knows, Johnny Cochran is going to become more and more central as things go along. And around the third or fourth episode, you begin to see the Dream Team come together, but you begin to see kind of the fracturing around the edges of the Dream Team. And that's when Courtney B. Vance really becomes kind of central. And then also around the same time, you start getting more Sarah Paulson-centric episodes, the sixth episode. Is cheekily titled Marsha, 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 and it's a very petty Marsha Clark episode, and she's great also. I think both Courtney B. Vance and Sarah Paulson are going to be very hard to beat for Emmys come, you know, 7 months from now.
It was one of those things, I threw this up on Facebook, that when I set my DVR for The People versus O.J. Simpson, I felt dirty, but I couldn't wait to see it. I really couldn't wait to see it. And it, the first episode for me did not disappoint. It was kind of everything I thought it was going to be. I'm not quite sure. I didn't study Robert Shapiro during, you know, the expose and the crime and the trial and all that, when he was on television all the time. I just don't remember him being that weirdly eccentric, or at least the kind of interestingly strange choices that Travolta is making, obviously eyebrows aside, but he's doing it's a very strange character, and I don't know how accurate it is.
I don't think it's particularly accurate based on what I remember from the courtroom and what I know from checking out YouTube clips and all of that.
Yeah.
Some people who have spent time around Robert Shapiro, who I know, claim that it's impressive. I can't speak to that.
Yeah.
The way I feel about it is that it's kind of the American Horror Story performance that's in a series where no one else is giving an American Horror Story performance.
Okay.
And it's like he's doing this strange, you know, and I'm not saying it's necessarily the worst thing in the world. It's just from an entirely different series. So it's very, very jarring to me. I think that if everybody else were doing oddball, larger than life performances, that would be one thing. But even Courtney B. Vance, who's playing Johnny Cochran, who was a caricature of himself back then and always was kind of a caricature,
yeah,
he's not playing like that. He's playing the guy like a man.
Yeah.
And Travolta's not doing that.
Yeah, okay. I liked it. So, I guess the five episodes that I have to look forward to, I'll probably be staying with it and enjoy it, correct?
Absolutely, for sure. And the other thing is, ESPN this summer is doing a five-night, 2 hours per night, so 10 hours of ESPN time, 7.5 hours of actual footage, 30 for 30 documentary miniseries on OJ, if you haven't gotten enough OJ yet. And I've already seen that because it premiered at Sundance a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And it's spectacular.
Okay.
I don't want to necessarily say it's better because they're doing different things, but that's the one that has sort of lingered in my mind. And I feel like come end of the year, you know, which is, of course, 10 months from now,
right,
that's going to be one that's going to be guaranteed to be top 10 for me. Whereas People versus O.J. Simpson, you know, I'm definitely going to be excited to see the next four episodes. And if they're really good, who knows? I think it's pretty good stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Well, before we jump away, it is from the same, you know, guys who make American Horror Story and Glee and all that, Ryan Murphy and that group. But the guys who wrote it, who adapted the book, I can't remember their names right now. The two guys, Larry.
There's Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski.
There you go. And they did The People versus Larry Flint. And what was the other high profile sort of similar thing?
I believe they did Ed Wood. I believe they've done a number of really good biopics, and they're guys who know how to do this. Man in the Moon, another big one.
There it is. Yeah.
So yeah, Larry Flint, Man in the Moon, and Ed Wood are the big biopics they've done.
Yeah, those are the, you know what, I had forgotten about Ed. I blanked on Ed Wood, but I just remember, the reason I remembered that the other two were because they were both Milos Forman films, but I blanked on Ed Wood, and I forgot they did that. But this seems to be in their wheelhouse. This is what they do, I guess, right?
And they're working from Jeffrey Toobin's book, so very well-researched. And, I do think it's very important that Murphy and Falchuk, Ryan Murphy and Brad Falchuk, who, you know, have done great work and compelling work between your favorite show, Scream Queens, and American Horror Stories, and all of that. They're producing here, and Ryan Murphy directed several of the episodes, but he didn't write any of that, and I think that that gives this a kind of balance. So I think it does have some things that are very notably them, but maybe it has a through line of sanity that lifts it to a higher level, and you know, everyone needs collaborators, so maybe this is a great match for those guys.
Do we know how that did for FX? Because everybody I know was really excited and was going to watch.
Well, FX pretends not to care about live ratings, so they're not boasting about it. It did a little bit over 5 million viewers in its first airing, and it will probably come close to doubling that in the first week, give or take. It did very well.
Okay.
It didn't necessarily break records. I think some people were thinking that it could have been sort of the biggest thing in FX history, and it was not immediately out of the bat.
Okay.
But it did well.
Okay, great. All right, okay, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg with us, and we're talking TV. He writes for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can check him out on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print. That's F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. More TV talk coming up. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN.
Morning, everybody. How are you? I'm Nick DiGilio. I'm your overnight guy here on 720 WGN. Welcome back to the show. Here till 5 a.m. Opening bell at 5, 6 a.m. Steve Cochran. As it always is and always will be. And 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/Nick D Show. My guest is Dan Feinberg. He visits us regularly. He's the TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and we love talking TV with Dan. We talked about The People versus O.J. Simpson. We talked a little bit about the American Masters episode last week that Elaine May directed about Mike Nichols. And now we're going to talk more television as well. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you much.
I don't know if you've seen it, because I don't see anything that you've written about it. Have you seen Baskets?
I have seen 5 episodes of Baskets. My colleague Tim Goodman wrote about it, and I liked Baskets more than Tim did. He gave it a tempered to negative review, and it took me a while to get into it, but by the 4th or 5th episode, I was kind of feeling the very, very strange vibe that it puts out. It's a strange show.
I watched the first 2 episodes, and I got to tell you, I thought it was great. I really loved it, and I think it's the first thing that the first project, and obviously because it was co-created and, you know, executive produced and written by Zach Galifianakis, it's the first project that he's ever done outside of, you know, the work that he's done on his own, you know, like stand-up and some of the stuff that he's done on his own, Between Two Ferns and stuff like that, that has captured what's weirdly funny about Zach Galifianakis. And it's not The Hangover, and it's not the other crap movies that he's made, The Dinner for Schmucks and all that stuff. That's not Zach Galifianakis being Zach Galifianakis and being really weird and really funny. This is absolutely that. So
It is a strange thing. I've told a bunch of people that I expect it's going to be around 270 people's favorite show ever, and a bunch of other people are going to think it's the worst thing they've ever experienced in their life. I am closer to favorite. I think, for example, I think Louis Anderson is spectacular.
I got to tell you something, Dan. I did not know that he was in it. No idea. And it's the best thing. I think it's the best thing he's ever done. I tweeted, you know, who would have known that the highlight of Louis Anderson's career would be playing Zach Galifianakis' mother. And when he first shows up, I'm like, what the hell is going on? And then for a couple seconds, but the fact that no one acknowledges it, you know what I mean? Like, he's playing a woman. He is playing Zach Galifianakis' mother. It's not like winky-winky. He's actually playing the character like you would think that Baskett's mother would be. And it's he's great.
You hear it if anyone had warned you about it, and you think, okay, this is going to be a stunt. It's going to be, oh, look, he's doing drag, whatever. No, he's just playing, as you say, he's playing this character's mom. And yeah, that is what he is doing, and he is human and funny and sad and real. It's really shocking, actually, how good he is.
No, that's exactly how I felt, Dan, while I was watching it. I was like, oh, my God, this is amazing. This is unbelievable. And I love the fact that it, you know, like you would immediately, because I didn't know when he popped up on screen, I'm like, what's going on here? But, yeah, obviously you think, oh, Louis Anderson, they cast Louis Anderson to play Zach Galifianakis' mother, and you would think, oh, wink, wink, wacky, wacky, it's going to be great, and it's not, and it's really great, and it adds another layer to the weirdness of the show. And the woman who plays his friend, Marcia?
Martha, I believe.
Martha,
yeah.
Oh, my God, like, where did he find this woman? She's amazing.
She is a stand-up comic, and her material is very much, as one would imagine, based on the episodes of Baskets you've seen, it's very much driven by sort of that deadpan sense of humor, and that is also what she is like when she came to the TPA press tour and she sat on the panel. That's kind of just how she talks. And apparently they've been buddies for 20 years, and they have this friendship that is kind of passive-aggressive and occasionally lightly abusive, and all of those dynamic things that are somewhat in the show, that's somewhat how their interaction is. Right. And she is a definite find of a very strange kind as well.
Yeah, I think it's terrific. For those people who don't know, Zach Galifianakis plays a guy who flunks out of French clown school, comes back to Bakersfield, California, obsessed, really wants to be a real clown, gets a job at a crappy rodeo as a rodeo clown. He's got a French wife who she married him for a green card, doesn't even live with him, takes $40 for HBO from him occasionally. He has a woman who works at Costco as an insurance person who drives him around. It's hard to describe without making it sound like, what? But I think it's great. Louis C.K. is executive producer of it, along with, who's the director, Jonathan?
Crystal,
yeah. And he and Zach Galifianakis put it together. It's not for everybody, that's absolutely sure. And I love what you said, Dan. 270 people are going to think it's the greatest thing they've ever seen, and everybody else is going to be like, what? But I think that's true.
And I think that's what FX expects of it. I think they want it to be several people's favorite show, and I think it is. And I actually raised my estimate. I think initially I was saying around 170 people, and it became clear that there were a few more people who were finding it in their sweet spot.
Yeah,
so
I'm one of
who
them.
Who knows, listener?
Yeah, I'm one of them.
Maybe that person.
Count me among those 270, Dan, okay? Hey, speaking of Louis C.K., let's talk. I haven't seen it yet, but let's talk about Horace and Pete. Tell everybody what that is and your thoughts.
Horace and Pete was this strange thing that Louis C.K. put up on his website, louisck.net, on Saturday morning with no warning, no announcement, no explanation. He just sent out an email saying, here, I just put up this thing called Horace and Pete. Pay $5 and you can have it on your computer. And no one knew what it was. No one knew who was in it. Well, it turns out it's a 67 minutes, so slightly over an hour, not really a comedy, not really a tragedy, kind of really a filmed play, except it's an original play, and it features, among other people, Steve Buscemi, Alan Alda, Edie Bryant, Jessica Lange, Edie Falco, and a bunch of other people who you'll recognize from either Louis C.K. show or just sort of that sphere of particularly quirky comedians, and it's almost hard to explain because it doesn't feel like anything else. And somewhat, I guess, the same way that Baskets doesn't, except that I wouldn't compare them. It really is like a play about these two guys who own a bar, and they're maybe going to lose the bar, and that's just where it is. And it was apparently filmed in the last weak because they're making political references to Donald Trump skipping the debate in Iowa and all of that.
Yeah.
Apparently, Louis just had his friends over and said, here, we're going to shoot this thing. And that's the kind of thing you can do if you're Louis C.K. And a lot of people seem to have paid $5 for it. So who knows?
Oh, okay. Well, I'm curious about it. I just haven't seen it yet, but I definitely plan on paying my.
I recommend it. It's the kind of thing that Louis C.K. can do that very few other people could do. So I'm amused that Louis C.K. wants to do it. It's kind of like the way when he puts up one of his comedy specials and he says, "Okay, this costs $5, or this costs whatever you want to pay me, or this was a really, really bad version of a concert, so don't bother giving me anything. I'm just putting it up online anyway." Louis can do that, and really no one else can do it. And so if he wants to use his powers for good, I encourage that. And if he eventually wants to use his powers for evil, I will understand that.
So sweet Louis C.K. So it sounds like he should wear a cape.
I honestly think he is one of the most stealthily powerful people in Hollywood. And if this is successful, if this somehow proves to be a way to turn the industry upside down, to turn the distribution system upside down, that will only make him look more powerful, like more of a ruler, a king, a prophet, however you want to view it. Or alternatively, maybe no one watched this. Maybe we'll never see a second episode of it, and he'll just go, I had some friends over, I made something I like.
Yeah, okay. All right, you got to admire that. That's pretty cool.
Oh, totally.
Okay, let's talk about Grease Live. I did not watch it, and I don't feel the need. I'm not compelled to catch up on it, but I understand that you liked it.
I did like it. According to the ads on TV, I called it breathtaking. Which,
oh, okay.
If I can look in the context of my review, I did use the word breathtaking. I used it in a particular extended contextual joke reference, whatever, that got lost. But I used the word. So
Wait. So they pulled breathtaking and put your credit on that.
I know the word was there. The word was totally in my review. And the word was there in a context in which I did say that it was breathtaking. At times, often. So I was fine with it. It was part of a context that kind of got lost when you use only one word in a blur.
You know
how that goes.
Yes, I do. By the way, I just want to mention, Dan, that I was quoted. I had a one word quote, and I'm quoted on the box for Cabin Boy.
I'm so happy for you.
And it says hilarious, and that's it. And I did say that there was a lot of hilarious things in it, but I'm quoted on it, and it's on the video box, and it's a proud achievement of mine. Especially now. I mean, now I mentioned that Chris Elliott, and of course now we lost Bob Elliott yesterday, and we're going to do a big tribute to him later on. But yeah, so I know what it means to have that word just taken. But in my case, I'm fine with it because it's Cabin Boy.
and I'm totally fine with it as well. It was in the context of talking about how in the opening shot, which is like this 5-minute tracking shot with Jesse J singing Grease is the Word and going through basically the entire set out into the Warner Brothers lot, past the crowd. This is amazing tracking shot, which you can't believe they did live, about how really she's probably out of breath by probably halfway through it. But the show wasn't so much about taking breath as breathtaking moments, and that was how it was all contextualized.
Oh, I got it. Okay.
It makes sense.
Okay. All right. Well, of all the, I mean, this seems to be a big trend now. I mean, it was an NBC thing, and now Fox is getting in on it. Are other networks going to be doing these live musicals?
Well, everyone wants live anything. It's why everyone jockeys for NFL football. It's the thing that you can guarantee that people will sit in front of the TV for and pay attention to the commercials, maybe. And so it's the holy grail for network television, and NBC had the patent, and then NBC didn't really do anything with it because people thought Peter Pan was awful. And then so Fox said, we can step in and we can do something. And then NBC did The Wiz, which was actually really good.
Yeah.
And then Fox came in and blew them out of the water with this because the NBC musicals have all been basically single stage things, no studio audience, and not exactly quite, you know, from a proscenium point of view, but they've all been about, here's what a theatrical live experience looks like. And so we know what that is, but it's also kind of lifeless on some level because you're not there live and it's happening. This, they had dozens of cameras, and the cameras are going everywhere. And it was directed by Thomas Kail, who is about to win a Tony in a couple months for Hamilton. You know, he's a god of Broadway. And just the things that they were able to do in a live broadcast are remarkable. And just the technical achievement of this makes it worthwhile. And I think you could still watch it on demand if you wanted to, you know, and you wouldn't lose anything. The question of how you feel about Grease as a musical or how you feel about Grease as a movie might impact that.
Yeah,
and it spends a lot of time trying to be that.
Yeah, and in that regard, that's what impacts it for me. So
and you know, so Aaron Tveit, who's a great young Broadway star, is really not very well cast as Danny, and he's not going to take anyone's mind off of John Travolta for a second. And Julianne Hough is a spectacular dancer, and they use a lot of her dancing abilities as Sandy, and, you know, all credit to her for that. But as an actress and as a singer, she's average at best.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of good supporting performances, and it's really impressive technically, just to imagine how this could have been done live, even with 3-4 months of rehearsal, which they had, both technical and with the actors.
Yeah.
It's still remarkable they did it.
Okay, well, that's impressive. Grease is just not my, it's not the word in my world.
No, it's not one of my favorites either, and that's part of why I sort of allow whatever wiggle room they want with it, is because I don't hold it sacred. So,
and I still can't get the taste out of Rock of Ages out of my mouth. So Julianne Hough is still, you know, pretty low on.
I can understand that, and also, even if you get invested in this, the next live musical-y thing that that Fox is doing is going to be The Passion, a Easter season Passion thing from Tyler Perry.
Oh.
So,
oh my God! Oh. Okay, I'm so glad that you said this before we're taking a break, Dan. Thank you, because I need a minute. Okay, Dan, hang on a second, okay?
Sure.
All right, there you go. Dan Feinberg just dropped a bomb on us right there. Oh, man. All right, we'll talk more with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. We're talking TV. We got more to talk about. Check him out at The Fine Print at Facebook and Twitter. The Fine Print, that's F-I-E-N. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Thursday morning on 720 WGN, and we'll be remembering Bob Elliott, amazing talent. Right now, though, we're talking with Dan Feinberg. Dan Feinberg is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and on Facebook at The Fine Print, and that's F-I-E-N. And we are talking TV, and we welcome Dan back to the show. Hello, Dan.
Hello. Now, I didn't tell you that Chris Daughtry of American Idol fame is going to play Judas in Tyler Perry's Passion. Does that make you more excited or less?
Oh, my God. Man. And this is coming. Is it going to be on Easter weekend?
It is going to be. I mean, I'm assuming it is.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine when else you would get away with it. I don't have the date. March 20th is when it's going to be. Palm Sunday. So.
Okay. There you go. Oh, boy. That's going to be something. Okay. Hey, let's talk about the SAG Awards a little bit here. And I watched them, you know, last week. And I don't know. You know, it was interesting, but I was talking with my friend here and movie critic who reviews movies with me, Eric Childress, on the show, and we were talking about how there's no way that people can complain about any diversity issues with the SAG Awards, but there was also this sort of inside of us, there was this cynicism that because the voting ended Friday, that it seemed to me and to Eric that maybe the voting went out, the people went out of their way to make sure that there was no diversity criticism. How do you feel about that?
You look at some of it and it's hard not to scratch your head, at least. On the other hand, people really do respect Idris Elba, except for the Academy. You know, he was nominated for lots of awards for Beasts of No Nation. He's won a Golden Globe for Luther. So, you know, these were not hugely shocking, but on the other hand, in this context,
right,
they seemed more striking. you know, everyone figures that Sylvester Stallone is really the favorite for the Oscar, and he wasn't even nominated for the SAG Award, so it wasn't like Idris Elba was going against, you know, the same competition as will be there. Also, if you look at the big ensemble winners, the big ensemble winner on the TV side was Downton Abbey, which brought 30 people up on the stage, every single one of them white.
Yes.
And the big ensemble winner for movies was Spotlight, which brought its entire cast up on stage, and every single one of them white. So, you know, you can either look and go, okay, here's a sign of optimism, or you can look and go, okay, but on the other hand.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that there was some consciousness of it, and I'm okay with people wanting to be conscious of how screwed up the Academy is and saying just point blank, look, you know, you look at all these old white Academy members complaining and saying, oh, but if someone, you know, was good enough, they would have gotten in. And this is just the simple way of saying, look, lots of people think that Idris Elba really was good enough.
Well, you know, and Idris Elba is awesome. I love the man, and I was happy to see that he won. He's Stringer Bell in my book, and he'll always be Stringer Bell. But I love that guy, but it just seemed a little bit, you know, I mean, even he made a comment about it. You know, when they came out to present to show the clip from Beasts, he came out and he said, "Well, welcome to Divergent." This was after Viola Davis won for How to Get Away with Murder. And he came out and said, "Well, welcome to Diversity TV." And so even he made a comment about it, which I thought was
he did. But I mean, even you look at that, and Viola Davis won, and she also won last year, and she also won the Emmy and all of that. But Taraji P. Henson wasn't nominated because the SAG voters wanted to nominate Maggie Smith for her 5 minutes every week.
Yeah, of course.
In a outstanding performance by a female actor in a drama category, that's, you know, already the nominations were ridiculous there, so fine. And then you look at the male actor in a drama series, and it's Kevin freaking Spacey, and you go, really?
Yeah.
And I feel bad for John Hamm, but if they wanted to make the point of diversity, that's where they could have gone with Rami Malek, and they did from Mr. Robot, and they didn't. So it wasn't like they were going down the list and going, okay, what can we do to make sure we're sticking it to the Academy at every turn, and we're just going to be all diversity. They made some nods, and you know, I kind of applaud them for doing that, because otherwise there would have been nothing at all to talk about.
No, that's true. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
Okay, there's Dan Feinberg here on 720 WGN. We're talking TV. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to pay tribute to Bob Elliott, one half of Bob and Ray. A comedic icon, a really brilliant man who passed away yesterday, and we're going to pay tribute to him, listening to some of the best Bob and Ray clips and some other stuff from talk shows and clip, and we'll listen to a couple of clips from Get a Life, that hilariously weird Chris Elliott, who is Bob Elliott's son, sitcom from Fox in the early 90s, and he was on that. We'll listen to some of that as well. So that's coming up right here on 720 WGN. Speaking of TV, Dan Feinberg is still with us. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print. That's FIEN, and he writes for The Hollywood Reporter, and we're talking TV. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you much.
Hey, we were talking about the SAG Awards before the break and everything, and you had a recent interview with Carol Burnett, and Carol Burnett won the Lifetime Achievement Award at the SAGs. And tell me a little bit about what that was like. You talked about the state of comedy stuff.
It was just a true pleasure. You know, sometimes my job is a drag. Other times I sit down on a couch for 45 minutes and listen to Carol Burnett tell stories. Mm. And, you know, the interview as it ran in The Hollywood Reporter was a very tightened version, but it was really just, you know, occasionally I would push her in the direction of the next story I wanted to hear her tell, or the next skit that I wanted to hear her remember from the Carol Burnett show, or the next recollection of the writers on the show, or all of those fantastic ensemble cast members. She's got such a sharp memory, largely because she keeps writing memoirs and she keeps doing like commentary tracks or DVD features as Carol Burnett show comes out in different formats. So she keeps getting refreshed on these things. But you know, she is sharp, she is funny, and she's lived a heck of a life. I mean, if you look at the SAG Lifetime Achievement Awards, they probably could have given her this one 15 years ago.
Oh, sure.
It was well and truly overdue, and it was a great moment during the show when Tina and Amy gave her her award, because they are the logical successors, if such things exist. Yeah. And they obviously were just so impressed and honored to be giving this award to her that it made the whole thing special.
Yeah, it was for me, it was the highlight of the show. It was absolutely the highlight of the show. And she's just, I mean, when I was growing up, I think I'm a couple of years older than Amy Poehler. I think I'm like 4 or 5 years older than Amy Poehler. But of that generation, every Saturday night, man, it was Carol Burnett every Saturday night without fail. So yeah, that was really cool. That must have been really great, man. See, that's cool when you get to interview people like that. It you know, it really does, because, you know, like I've been lucky enough to interview a lot of really great people, and, you know, and I also, you know, as you know, Dan, I review movies here on the radio station. So when I get to interview somebody like John Carpenter for like an hour, it kind of makes up for the Tyler Perry movies that I have to sit through. So kind of.
No, and anytime you and as you know, anytime you get to do that kind of length interview, when you actually get the 45 minutes or the hour. Yeah. It's so special because of all of the time that you only get 5 minutes,
sure,
or you only get 10 minutes or whatever. So, you know, someone like a Steven Soderbergh, who insists that when he does one-on-one interviews, he won't do less than 30 minutes or 45 minutes because he just thinks there's no point. Those are the special people, the people who know that you can't get a good interview in a 7-minute soundbite situation.
Yeah. I do want to mention that while I was watching it and I saw that, you know, that a lot of people of color and ethnicity were winning on the SAG Awards, I kept thinking to myself, boy, the writers at SNL must be really kind of upset, because anybody who goes to watch the clip from a couple of weeks ago online where they did the bit about all the white actors winning in these, you know, for being in the background of African-American movies.
Mm-hmm.
The bite of that scene is going to be gone, because the place where it took place was at the SAGs, so it was the
but still, the Oscars are going to come up in a week, and 30 million people are going to watch the Oscars,
yeah,
and like 5 million people watch the SAG.
No,
Awards,
I know, so. I know, but I'm just saying that but as far as like the writers' room at SNL, they're like, damn it, we've set that at the SAG Awards, and you know, instead of the Oscars, which I thought was, you know.
I'm just astounded that the Saturday Night Live has gotten to the place where they can make fun of the lack of diversity.
Yeah.
Places.
Yeah. 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 Because I guess they got rid of the pot and the kettle, I guess. So
look, they had a huge problem that Lorne Michaels refused to acknowledge for years, and they really have fixed it.
They
and
have,
they're
yeah.
not, you know, fixing it sounds wrong, because they still got plenty of problems, but
right.
they've made corrections that have helped the show.
I think. I agree. Okay, cool. That's great. All right, let's talk about the ABC miniseries here with Richard Dreyfuss, Bernie Madoff. Let's talk a little bit about that. You've seen it, and how do you feel about it?
I think that it's something that TV networks don't do anymore, and it ends up being a strange thing because of it. You just don't see many two-night miniseries movie events, and so this becomes a four-hour TV movie for no really good reason. HBO is doing a Barry Levinson directed version with Robert De Niro and Michelle Pfeiffer, and it's going to have so many advantages just because it doesn't need to worry about expanding over multiple nights. It doesn't need to worry about commercials. And so this thing is constantly cutting to stupid cliffhangers, because we know the story, to really cheesy commercial music, and you often lose the fact that Richard Dreyfuss was having a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And Richard Dreyfuss is a guy who obviously likes to keep working because, you know, he's got his civic interests, and they don't necessarily pay for themselves. And so he's got his crusade to teach civics in America, and that's not a money-making venture, so he does TV projects that sometimes people don't see. But this one, it feels like he's kind of in the spirit of it. And he's really good. Black Danner and the second night gets to be really good. You know, just if you could watch it somehow in a 100-minute version of it, I think it might be really good. But over two nights, it's
sort of bloated and strangely edited, and it just reminds you of why this isn't what the networks do so well anymore.
Yeah. Now, who's creatively behind it, director or creator?
It's just a couple of veteran TV writers and producers. There's not the same sort of driving force that, like a Barry Levinson on the HBO version. So it's basically, it was based on a book by an ABC News producer. And so there was some collaboration with the ABC News department and ABC, which doesn't typically happen, but it's that collaboration that kind of got this thing made.
Yeah.
And, I wish it were a little bit better, but Richard Dreyfuss is good, and I feel like it's probably, if you want to go back, maybe the best thing he's done since Mr. Holland's Opus. And so if you're a Richard Dreyfuss fan, I think there are definitely reasons to watch it. If you're not, there's so much of this corporate malfeasance stuff going around on TV, whether it's billions or what have you. So a lot of people are going to feel like it's kind of unnecessary anyway. And so for Richard Dreyfuss fans, mostly.
Okay. All right. I have to ask you about You, Me, and the Apocalypse. I just watched the first episode last night, and it's not at all what I expected it to be. When I saw the commercials for it, first of all, the first thing that popped into my head was, well, screw you. We've already got a really great sitcom about the end of the world that's on right now.
Sure.
That was the first thing that popped into my head. And I just wasn't ready for it. And then I watch it, and it's not at all based upon, I didn't read a lot about it or anything, but based upon just the commercials and the promos that I've seen that NBC was showing, it's nothing like what I thought it was going to be. I didn't know it was an hour. It's not really a comedy, and I didn't realize that until about 10 minutes in. And it feels, and I don't know the background on this, this production, Dan, but I'm really interested. It felt very sort of European to me. It didn't feel like a full, like, American, network production. It just felt like, what the hell is this doing on NBC? And I liked it. I thought it was very good, but it wasn't at all what I expected. Do you kind of understand what I'm saying?
Oh, of course. And the reason why it feels like it was a European production is because it was a British-American co-production, but it was really primarily a British production that NBC came on to.
Okay, that's what it feels. Okay, good. I'm not nuts.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it is completely the strange thing. And I haven't had the chance to watch it yet because it was a Tim Goodman review, and there's so much stuff that's premiered in January that I haven't gotten to it yet. Yeah. But are you saying it's good?
I am saying it's good. But I just had to adjust my expectations and, the rhythm of it. You know what I mean? Because I in my head, I expected a half-hour sitcom. I don't know why, but that's what I expected. And when I turned on my DVR and I saw that it ran an hour, I was like, what? And it starts out, tonally, it starts out comedy. And then it kind of takes this shift, and it's the first episode sets up the entire series. It's told in flashback, and it sets up the entire series and sets up all the main characters and where they were in different parts of the world when this comet is about to hit. And that's the setup. And, the main character is a British actor who I'd never really even heard of before. And the only sort of big American stars have supporting roles, except for Jenna Fisher. Jenna Fisher's a lead. But Rob Lowe has a supporting role. Megan Mullally is kind of in it. She's got a small role. But the production values are really impressive. It just feels, like, wow. I mean, they put a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of creativity into a show that I just thought was going to be a knockoff, wacky, end-of-the-world show, and that's not at all what it is. And I think it's really good, actually, Dan.
It did okay in its premiere, and I wonder if there was any way that NBC could have gotten the message across better or differently on what it was. It's airing on NBC Thursday at 8, and so that's a time slot which has some obvious comedy ties to it, with the decades that it was a comedy time slot. But on the other hand, the last year and a half, it hasn't been, because NBC kind of gave up on comedy on Thursday. And so there's a lot of people trying to figure out what to expect. And I don't know if anyone exactly had a clue what it was when they went into it. And some people seem to have been amused because of that, and other people seem to have been disappointed because of that.
Yeah.
So,
well, I thought it was really good and interesting. I just had to like adjust myself while watching it. I don't mean what people think I mean. I didn't adjust myself. But it's, and then I looked up the creator of it, and I guess it's the guy, it's a British guy who only did one other show, and it was in England. And I'd never heard of it before. And I was actually impressed by it. I thought it was good. I'm really curious to see what you think of it, Dan.
No, I'm at some point looking forward to watching it. There's just so much stuff premiering this month.
Yeah.
You know, so I've watched 10 episodes, for example, of Judd Apatow's Love on Netflix. That took a lot of time. And I watched 8 episodes of 11/22/63. That took a lot of time.
Oh, you know, boy.
Lots of stuff.
Okay. All right. And the next time we talk, we can talk about those, because I believe they probably will be airing by the time you get on.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, Dan, thank you so much, man. Everybody can read you at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, Twitter and Facebook, and on Hollywood Reporter. Dan, always a pleasure, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Anytime, Nick.
Okay, take care, buddy. Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter, talking TV, and he'll join us again in a few weeks.